retirement system. And we will open work sessions on House Bill 2003 and call Margaret Halleck, governor's advisor on PERS and other important issues, as well as Mark Johnson. Welcome to the committee today. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Chair Knope, members of the committee. On behalf of Governor Kulongoski, I'm here today to present to you our proposals and suggestions for reforming the current PERS system. We offered these concepts for your consideration as amendments to House Bill 2003, the PERS Reform and Stabilization Act. We developed these concepts after discussion with a bipartisan group of legislators, including members of the committee and the chair of the committee, sponsors of the bill, and other people involved in the diverse discussion on the issue to date. Our package of reforms is intended to restructure the PERS system for the future and correct errors of the past in a defensible and responsible way that generates significant savings, protects employees' accrued benefits, and delivers a fair and adequate pension to our workforce. Indeed, at the outset, we want to acknowledge the value and dedication of the thousands of public employees in our state. The problems of the pension system are not their fault, and indeed, public employees have made excellent suggestions during this legislation and others for constructive reform. But nonetheless, we must now turn around this system, which is in financial crisis, and make it actuarially sound and accountable to the public. To put the system back on firm financial ground and to correct past errors, we suggest three main actions. First, shifting the 6% member contribution from the PERS account to a separate defined contribution account. This is slightly different than the current provision in House Bill 2003. We're going to suggest to you a restructured mechanism for crediting interest to member accounts that essentially suspends the guaranteed assumed rate during periods of low investment returns and institutes a more sensible pay-as-you-go earnings policy. It is our interpretation of the contract that the guarantee should be met over the life of a career and not on a year-in, year-out basis. And third, temporarily suspend future cost of living adjustments for retirees who benefited from the excess interest credit to their accounts in 1999. These are complicated, and I'll return to them shortly with the chair's permission. First, I wanted to reemphasize that the governor's statement in January of this year, when he stated that PERS reform is one of his top priorities for the legislative session, and set standards for public pension reform at that time. And at that time, he included among his standards a new Oregon retirement plan, a fair, sustainable, affordable, based on standard defined benefit plans. He announced that we needed to have substantial savings from the current system that reduce the cost to taxpayers for this coming biennium as well as future biennium and level out the escalating employer contribution rates. A third standard was that the new system must be accountable with new governance and be more accountable to employers and employees. Our goal is to eliminate much of the uncertainty that plagues the current system. A fifth standard is to protect retirees, not reduce benefits of people who have already retired, and mitigate impact on current employees so that those who have not yet retired retain what they have accrued in their accounts. Actually, Kara, I had open slides. Forgot these. Okay, so we just finished with that. Thanks. The legislature has accomplished many of these, and we thank you for your hard work. You have or are completing work on key parts, including a new governance structure that will be created by House Bill 2005, new mortality tables implemented under House Bill 2004, and the beginning of a process of altering the way interest is accredited to member accounts in House Bill 2001. We understand that discussions are continuing regarding a pension plan for new employees. I want to be very clear today that the governor opposes a 401k type defined contribution successor plan, supports a defined benefit or a hybrid plan that includes both a guaranteed pension at a lower cost and a companion 401k type DC component. We need a pension system that yields a dependable pension for public employees, one that will attract and retain quality employees at an affordable cost. And a shared risk hybrid plan meets those criteria. But we all know that the real issue in terms of cost is with the current system, and we must turn our attention to costs that are not sustainable and savings that must be addressed. The framework for our proposals is that our reading of House Bill 2003 as it is currently drafted is that it is largely focused on remedying errors found in the Judge Lipscomb case brought by the City of Eugene, not entirely but largely. And indeed, this is an important case and usefully illuminated some of the problems with the PERS system. Our proposal addresses one of the problems highlighted in this case, that the board in 1999 failed to create adequate reserves, credited more to member accounts than recommended by the actuary. And this failure led in part to the current financial problems, and it should be corrected. So the City of Eugene case is an important one, but it is our view that it should proceed through the judicial system and appropriate remedies be sorted out in the courts and by the parties to the case. We believe that the duty of the legislature and the governor is broader than the issues in this one case. We have a duty to restore the financial stability of PERS by making structural reforms that will mitigate the current financial problems and prevent another crisis. We are now in a period of financial exigency, and this alone requires us to act to correct the destabilizing features of our system. It is not an ordinary time, and we need to protect the critical services of the state, municipalities, and schools by arresting the escalating costs of the system. And finally, we believe the system as it currently operates delivers benefits far beyond those envisioned by the legislature. Decades of changes and enhancements created a series of unintended consequences resulting in pensions higher than envisioned by policymakers. In particular, the interaction of the guaranteed interest crediting and the money match calculation of the retirement benefit created unsustainable costs. So our proposals thus are designed to correct past errors, reform the fundamental mechanism of the system, and create a fair and sustainable public pension system. So I'll turn now to the three reforms. With respect to the 6% member contribution, we agree in general with the proposal in House Bill 2003 to prohibit the member contribution being added to regular accounts in the future. But we believe that this money should be shifted to a separate defined contribution account. Removing it from the regular PERS accounts halts the compounding of these contributions, which then must be matched in the future. But this 6% is the members' money, and it should remain a part of their ultimate pension system. We should not provoke cries that we are taking it away from them, but should retain these funds in a companion account. And this new defined contribution plan could be part of a successor pension system for new hires. Secondly, and this is the kind of the complicated piece, is that we believe that we should restructure the mechanism for crediting interest to Tier 1 member accounts. This is a significant proposal to address the unsustainable and escalating costs of the current system that currently each year credits Tier 1 regular accounts with the assumed rate of interest each and every year. The assumed rate is set by the actuary to reflect the long-term 30-year rate of return on invested assets. We believe the system is not functioning properly and that this long-term rate of return is credited each and every year. Accounts rise each year irrespective of actual investment returns. Our proposal restructures the guarantee. We would not credit the assumed rate each and every year, but rather ensure the guarantee is met over the course of the employee's career. We believe this is a more accurate description of legislative intent and the contract promised to public employees. Currently, members are credited. I just need to explain a little bit about this mechanism. Currently, members are credited each year with the current assumed rate of 8%. When earnings are greater than 8%, the board is supposed to place funds in a gain-loss reserve to offset years when there's less than when the fund earns less than 8%. That gain loss reserve makes up that difference between actual and the assumed rate. When there is no money, however, in the gain loss reserve that could make up that difference and market rates fall below 8%, the assumed rate is still credited to member accounts, and that difference is posted in what is called the deficit account. Yeah. In the deficit reserve. So our proposal makes the first priority system to eliminate any deficit in this reserve account. When there is a deficit in the reserve account, no interest will be paid to the member accounts. When assets begin to recover, we believe that the account should be credited at market rates up to 8%. And when there is a positive balance in the gain loss reserve, the system can function as it does now, which is that if there is the balance there, it can make up that difference. There is right now a $1.95 billion in this deficit reserve account. That is the amount that was posted to make up the difference between the assumed rate and actual earnings in recent years. This deficit will increase if we continue to credit accounts at 8%, even while the fund loses money or stays in deficit. Our proposal suspends crediting that assumed rate when there are insufficient funds to do so. We believe we should have a more pay-as-you-go scheme in which there must be reserves or sufficient earnings to credit the full assumed rate. This reduces, interestingly, it reduces the liability of the system in the future, but it also protects the asset base. The following diagram at the bottom illustrates this mechanism. It is essentially the current mechanism for crediting, but it stretches out the mechanism to take account for market fluctuations. So, in summary, when there's a deficit, no interest is credited. Market rates are credited between 0 and 8%, and the gain loss reserve can be used to bring up the interest credited to 8% as long as there is a balance in the gain loss reserve. And then House Bill 2001 takes over, and crediting is allowed above 8% as long as that gain loss reserve is completely full and has been full for 3 years. So we believe this proposal is a bookend to House Bill 2001. Two aspects of this mechanism are worthy of special attention. First, and I think this is most important, if this mechanism were instituted, we would no longer add to our unfunded liability during down markets by posting earnings that we don't have. It makes no sense to credit a long-term rate during short-term downturns and thereby add to our future liability. Mm-hmm. Second, it has been mentioned many times that the main cause of the current unfunded liability is the loss in asset values, is the downturn in asset values. This proposal protects the assets by keeping earnings after a downturn and eliminating that deficit. And once if the assets improve, great, we'll get out of this. If they don't improve, we won't add to our future liability, and that's really the critical issue. This, it simultaneously reduces future liability and adds to the asset base. This reform reduces the 2001 unfunded liability by $4.9 billion and reduces 03-05 employer rates by 4.3 percentage points. The third piece of our package is to recovering excess interest crediting, and this is also a sort of a variation on what currently is in House Bill 2003. One finding in the Eugene versus PERS case was that the PERS board abused its discretion, according to Judge Lipscomb, by crediting more than double the guaranteed rate to Tier 1 at regular accounts in 1999. Throughout the 90s, the board followed aggressive crediting strategies during the boom markets, driving up the regular accounts, Tier 1, without sufficient reserves in the gain loss and contingency reserves, in violation of their stated goals. The actuary in 1999 recommended a credit of 11.3%, with the balance of investment earnings to be placed in reserve accounts. Instead, the board credited 20% to member accounts, and these large account balances subsequently compounded and interact with the money match feature in a way that destabilizes the entire system. We do not seek to provide an exclusive remedy for the Eugene versus PERS case. However, it seems clear to us that the PERS board credited excessive investment earnings in 1999, and we believe it is proper to recapture the amount of that error. For active members, this is accomplished, in our view, by altering the crediting formula in the way that we just described, so that member accounts will receive zero interest if and when a deficit in the reserve account exists. The current deficit exists in part because of that overcrediting, so not being credited to raise that deficit, I think, in part pays back that overcrediting for current and inactive accounts. And this is the hard part. In the interest of equity and symmetry, we also support the proposal to temporarily suspend future cost of living adjustments for recent retirees who retired under Tier 1 money match and who benefited from the 1999 interest credit. Thus, our proposal is to calculate the amount of overcrediting, which would be the difference between the 20% and 11.3 in 1999, for members who retired after April 1st of 2000 and until March 31st of next year, which is the period over which the overcrediting and the 8% guarantee is in place, should this proposal advance. And these retired members participated in the boom years of the 90s and, we believe, contribute at least in part to the solution to the system's financial crisis. These changes are prospective, will not reduce the monthly annuity of any retiree, but it does hold them constant until that amount is, quote, paid back in the manner described by the actuary in his impact statement. This reform would reduce the 2001 unfunded liability by $414 million in employer rates by 0.39%. Mark Johnson, the PERS actuary, who is here today to answer questions, has estimated the system-wide impacts of these three reforms along with the impacts of House Bill 2001, which is already passed, the cap on earnings, and House Bill 2004. I think we're kind of behind on this. I'm not paying attention. Oh. Okay, here. And House Bill 2004, the new mortality table. So House Bill 2001, 2004, and these three proposals would have the following combined impact. Roughly speaking, it cuts the unfunded actuarial liability in half for now and in the future. The long term, you know that the projected liability was at 17 and going to 18 billion, and this would cut it down to $7.5 billion. The average employer contribution, which was on its way to 26-27%, would, with this reform, level out in the 16%-17% range. And the funded ratio of the system, which was in the two-thirds or 67% range, would return to the low 80% with these reforms. All, I think, excellent showings of financial health for a pension system that operates with over such a long period of time. Furthermore, a lower cost successor system would reduce the employer rates even further. Thus, these proposals dramatically reduce the unfunded liability. We do not yet know the impacts on different members of the system, and of course we understand this is an important question. Recent retirees may not receive COLA increases. Tier 1 members will be affected by the new policy regarding crediting and the issue of guaranteeing the assumed rate over the term of their career rather than on a year-by-year basis. Both Tier 1 and Tier 2 counts will grow more slowly as a result of the shift of member contributions. And this, however, these contributions will continue to earn interest in a companion or successor defined contribution plan. The ultimate effect is that more current PERS members will retire under the full formula, which delivers a pension of about 55% of salary for career employees. I think another point, though, is if the assets recover, member accounts will be less affected. If the assets do not recover, we will not increase the unfunded liability of the system, however, if this is adopted. It will be important to discuss how members might transition from the current system to a new system if these reforms were to take place. Tier 1 members may well want to switch into variable accounts, or we might consider incentives to move them into defined contribution plans altogether if they so desired. Obviously, we can't discuss this seriously until we have more clarity about a successor system. So in conclusion, our Shreveport Part Reform Package includes shifting the member contribution to a separate account, severing the link between the assumed rate and annual interest credits, especially during volatile economic times, and recapturing excess crediting of 1999. In combination with new mortality tables and stricter policies on crediting earnings over 8%, we believe this produced the savings we need for public institutions and will put the PERS system on a sound actuarial path. We urge your serious consideration of these proposals, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And
questions? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I appreciate Ms. Halleck coming forward with, and there's a lot of really good ideas here. I am concerned that the long-term plan still gets us inching out of the current difficulties over a long period of time. But with regard to the overview of the package, the idea that that we might be able to recapture the overcredit amount from 1999 by temporarily suspending the cost of living increases to members who retired under the money match between 2000 and 2004, I'm a little bit anxious about what that would do and how long that would actually recover, and whether or not that particular item, which I've numbered item 3 on the overview of the reform package, has been demonstrated in the final graph on the back, if any of that recapture has somehow been demonstrated, and would those folks, I guess I would like to just know just a little bit more about how long it would take to recapture that overcrediting. It was very substantial, and it affected many more folks than just those 2000-2004 retirees.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, first of all, it did affect many more people, but we believe that if the change in crediting were to be implemented and member accounts were credited with zero to active member, that would repay their portion of the overcrediting. And then the question is, should recent retirees who are also credited be asked to contribute? Exactly. And it is a difficult question. I have heard a vast array of opinion on this. There are many people currently in the system that think that basic equity would require some contribution from people that participated in what some call a windfall or an error. Well, active members, the other mechanism asks the contribution from them through the crediting, through a new crediting policy, and so the suspension of cost of living is the contribution from the retirees who also benefited from that in that window of time.
Mr. Chair, I would just point out that Judge Lipscomb didn't call it a windfall or an error. He called it a breach of fiduciary duty and a violation of the law.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative McPherson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Margaret, it appears to me that the proposal does not reduce the benefit of any member. Rather, it recovers amounts that have been overcredited in the past by preventing further increases. Is that a fair understanding?
Representative Knope, Representative McPherson, yes. That's the basic design, and I'm just want to say that the actuary should be, feel free to jump in here, especially because he understands this much better.
In fact, I have a question for him, with the chair's permission. Mark, how long would it take, assuming an 8% annual return, how long would it take to work our way out of the deficit in the reserve account? That is, how many years of zero return would there be on the Tier 1 fixed accounts?
Representative McPherson, that's an excellent question. A lot of it depends on how quickly people retire. For example, that as Margaret mentioned, the current deficit reserve associated with Tier 1 member accounts is $1.9 billion at the end of 2002. At that same point in time, the sum of all Tier 1 member accounts was $8.8 billion. Divide that, you get about 23%. At 8% a year, that tells you it's approximately 3 years. However, as those individuals retire and don't receive 3 years of zero. If somebody only receives 2 years with zero interest, then somebody else is going to have an extra year. So on average, it could be, obviously, will be more than three. It may be 4 to 5 going along with zero before interest is credited.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair, if I could
follow up.
It appears that then the effect is that the people who are at or closer to retirement age have the opportunity, if they were inclined to retire, to avoid participating in the recovery of the deficit, and that those who are a little further out from retirement, whose expectations aren't as fixed as it would be likely to be closer to retirement, would tend to share more than as that process works along.
Well, my understanding is that the proposal attempts to avoid that type of crack for somebody to leave without sharing some of the pain, if you will. And the way that would work is if somebody retires this year, that member will be subject to the COLA suspension provision of this bill. So they essentially will be paying back the earnings above the 11% that were credited in 1999. If they retire after the point at which 1 year of zero earnings is credited, in other words, if they retire sometime after April of next year, after the 2003 earnings has been credited at zero, then the proposal says that that's enough, that they don't then receive a suspension of their COLA. They'll get their full COLA. I would also like to make one comment about Representative Butler's comment about how long will this take a retiree. If you have received copies of my letter to Margaret dated April 15th, if you have it in front of you, on page 5, I outline my understanding of how this works. And essentially for many retirees, it will not recover all of the excess earnings because the proposal is not going back and recovering anything from the past. It's simply suspending the COLA and you're waiting for it. If you're with me at the top of page 5, what I did was I showed an example of a benefit that was 10% higher than it would have been had interest not been credited the way it was for 1999. So the left hand is what the individual would have received, retired in 2000 with $110 a month and then going up by 2% compounded every year. Looking on the year 2003, their benefit now would be $116.73. What the proposal says is we go back and recalculate what that benefit would have been had they retired with a different amount of interest credited in 1999. In other words, 11.3% instead of 20. Let's just say that's 10% less. Right now, their benefit would have gone up to $106.12 with 2% compounding and continued to go up. What the proposal says is, in the third column, you're now at 116.73, but instead of getting your next COLA increase, you're going to stay at $116.73 until such time as your recalculated amount would have gotten that high. So for this individual, and I've shaded the areas where it's suspended, it's 4 years suspended, and then the fifth year goes up to 117.17, which is where the member would have been in 2008 had they retired under the original amount. Now, the reason this does not recover the full amount is that you're not going back to the years 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003 and try to recover the amounts that were paid that would not have been under the recalculated amount. So it's only recovering in the future. If somebody retires now, you're going to recover everything. If somebody retired 1 year ago, you'll recover a lot, but not all. And this is the worst case, somebody retired just after 1999 in terms of recovery, and they are expected to recover somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% of that extra interest. And I hope that helps you out.
Mr. Chair, if I follow up, why wouldn't one just continue the suspension of the COLA adjustment for that person who'd retired longer ago, assuming that they continued to live, so there's still COLA increases one could recapture from? Why wouldn't one simply extend out that COLA recovery to fully recover from that individual, so that the only people one wouldn't achieve a recovery from fully would be people who had who died before the full recovery had been made.
That could be done. It would be a little bit more complicated. You'd have to calculate the value of, you know, each month's payment that wasn't made, accumulated, and then kind of hold it in account. This proposal was patterned after, I believe, the parts of House Bill 2003, where this was the strategy for recovery. There's certainly nothing wrong with pursuing, you know, the way you have to recover fully from every retiree, but this process that we've analyzed here only recovers future differences.
Mm-hmm. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Another question?
The effects of discontinuing for a time further earnings credits to the Tier 1 member accounts affects just then the money match benefit, and as we know, a member gets the better of the money match or the full formula benefit. For those members for whom it is then, as a result of this change, the full formula benefit that they retire under rather than the money match, how does that benefit compare to the benefits of public employee pension systems across the country? Would Oregon's full formula be about the same? Is it poorer than, better than? How does it compare to other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the full formula, as you're aware, is a 1.67% times years of service times final average for three years of salary. All of those provisions are similar to what I would say is a typical public employee retirement system. Basically, after a 30-year career, the employee would receive 50% of their last 3 years' average salary. That's not unusual. That's fairly typical. And likewise, the police and fire full formula is also designed to replace 50% of their final average three salary after a career. The only difference is the reason it's a higher multiplier is the police and fire career is defined as 25 years instead of 30 years. And once again, that is very typical across the country as well, the difference in career lengths and defining the pension.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you. Mark, referring again to your page 5 there, and the first line in year 2000, their originally calculated amount of $110 with the recalculated amount of $100. Does that reflect the full 1999 overcrediting?
This is an illustration to show
how that.
Roughly you had the board credited 20%, and the PERS calculation is the what interest rate would have been credited had the PERS board filled up the gain and loss reserve and set up a contingency reserve was 11.33%. So roughly you're talking about 8 or 9%. We compounded a little bit. It's roughly in this order of magnitude right here.
Okay. And
my expectation is that the PERS staff will have to calculate this for each individual because there's going to be a lot of individual characteristics of how long people worked in their accounts and what their salaries were and so forth. There's a lot of different, as you're well aware, I'm sure, complexities involved, and our recommendation would be to do an individual calculation for each person in order to be fair.
Representative Butler.
We're going to have a bigger computer, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up in that regard. So,
Representative Butler, I think Jim Boyko is going to hold you to that.
And that's what concerns me, Mr. Chair. The concern I've got here is that do you have any idea under this modified crediting method, it appears to me that very few people would actually, because of this very light suspension, very few people would actually restore to the program the amount that they had been overcredited.
That's true. The only, Chair Representative Butler, the only folks that would restore everything would be the people that retire this year. Because what's going to happen is you're going to say you're going to suspend all your COLAs until you hit where you would have under the calculator. So it does for people who retire now. That's what I meant about it. It avoids the loophole, the crack for somebody to get out without either suffering, if you will, the pain of a suspended COLA or the pain of receiving a 0% interest credit for year 2003.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Just by comment, by way of comment, this method of calculations is not fully recovering the overcrediting, and it certainly is not immediately. And I'm wondering, those were the two directives of the Lipscomb decision, and I guess we'll have to wait for that to get to the Supreme Court, but it seems like every time we come to those two words, we strain it in that and swallow a camel, because we sure don't want it fully, and we sure don't want it immediately. And I sure would like to see a way to figure out how to have, particularly those folks who still have their accounts wide open, to come back and be able to fully recover immediately, so that we do not have to make individual calculations from this point forward. Now, the difficulty that I have is, it's easy for us to sit and talk about today, every individual's account is going to have to be hand-calculated and fully manipulated. The concern I've got with that is, we've got folks calling in every month wanting that calculation. And if I've got that 40,000 times in a year, without a single retiree amongst that group, incidentally, or if I've got it 200,000 times, that is a mess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if I could, I would just say that this proposal has an individual calculation only for the retirees who benefited and who retired. For everyone else, there is not an individual calculation. We are assuming that the new interest crediting mechanism would be their contribution to the financial stability and the overcrediting.
Mr. Chair, if what we're saying is, from this point forward, when somebody calls in and wants to know what their retirement benefit is, we don't have to tell them. Oh. That's great. We don't have to be accurate, that is.
What I meant was that with respect to this issue of 99 overcrediting, we do not believe you have to calculate that for every single member in the system, just this one group, because this has three rationales. This reform, the overcrediting is one, financial exigency, and shifting or reinterpreting the guarantee from a short run year by year guarantee to a long run, and making sure that the floor for when people retire is the guaranteed rate over the course of their career, not every single year. So that does involve some individual calculations, but not on the 99 earnings crediting piece. That was my clarification.
But, Mr. Chair, the concern I've got is that these folks are calling in on regular basis now, whether they retire or not. If we just had to hand calculate one time for every employee, we'd be in hog heaven. The difficulty that we've got is that these folks call in. We have, in the Ways and Means process, ask how many calculations we're actually performing, and you'd think we were running a program for 50 million people. That's how heavy the calculations are on a regular basis. And my concern is that these are the folks who would most likely be calling in on a regular basis asking for that information. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, isn't that why we passed a bill to charge a fee for people who call more than several times?
Well, we did do that, and I think they did come. I think that that bill will probably have some effect, but I think we all know the problems as it relates to the PERS computers and how difficult this whole situation is to unravel. And I think we all wish we weren't at this point, but clearly we are, and I think we need to find a solution to it. Representative Richardson.
Ms. Halleck, I want to make sure that I have a clear understanding, because we need to be able to go back and explain this to teachers and to municipal workers who aren't thoroughly involved with what's going on in this room and haven't been for the last couple of months like we have. Am I correct that basically the 8% was an assumed average income for investments over a period of time? I've been told 40 years, I've been told 26 years, but a long period of time. And that the problem that we're in is basically related to decisions that were made that took an average, which means it's going to be above it and it's going to be below that over a period of time, and made it into a floor. And then it became 8% or better, and when it was 20 or 25%, there's over 20% being accredited to the accounts, and now we're in a negative point, and have been for several years, but we can't do anything except pay the 8%. And so since it was only above that, we essentially, by paying more than the 8%, paid in advance to members what over a long period of time would have basically averaged out. And so if that's the case, then it was suggested at one point that it's more like giving your bank account or having a miscalculation in your bank account, and someone messes up at the bank and they put $20,000 in your account, and then what's your argument? Well, it's been given to me, I've been planning on it, so I'm going to keep it. And so there has been one suggestion, which is not the one that you're making, but one suggestion is that you go back because of miscalculations and ask people to pay it back, mm-hmm. which would be devastating for many people who've planned their lives around what's taken place over the last few years. And so you've chosen a second course, which is to essentially say that's been given in advance, and so now we're going to not continue to pay it, but basically hold where the level is until it gets paid back over time. And so that is the least disruptive for those that are in the system. Is that basically what you're talking about?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yeah, that I think that is a fair characterization of at least part of the mechanism, especially as it relates to the overcrediting of 1999 earnings. But I think it's even more fundamental than that. I mean, our view is that we should promise to Tier 1 member accounts that their regular account at the end of their career will grow at the long-term assumed rate compounded annually, mm-hmm. but that it doesn't necessarily have to grow at that rate each and every year. And so we are saying the floor is 8% over time, and we think that should be part of the plan. And so we are talking about sort of this more structural, fundamental smoothing of these changes over time, in addition to the 99 in the particular 99 year. So we're mixing those two rationale.
Okay, follow up? So this, I like the term smoothing. That helps explain it a lot, rather than deal with a huge overpayment with something that's draconic.
Right.
It would be to smooth it out. I'm also concerned about what Representative Butler has said, in that the suggestions, as we look at this, and we all will need to go over the materials that you've provided, but it may be that there is a way that it can be done sooner, maybe less focus on individual calculations and more on general adjustment or general rule for recovery from the period of time. But I want to know that I very much appreciate all that you've provided.
Other questions? Representative Barker.
Just one clarification, if I may. So, while we say the floor is 8%, but we're saying now for a foreseeable future of some time, it'll be probably zero. And we're hoping to get the 8% back eventually, but until we catch up with the overcrediting, and of course the stock market didn't hold, but essentially the overcrediting of the accounts, the $20,000 that was put in by mistake, or said, okay, we're not going to put any more in your account, even though until we reach that point, even to flatten it back out.
That's correct.
Poorly asked.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, it really is two concepts. One is the overcrediting in a particular year, believe, and the smoothing over time. So the promise is that at the end of the career, the account would have grown at the assumed rate, compounded annually. The problem that we've gotten into is, as Representative Richardson said, it got credited and then ratcheted up, you know, in some very large crediting with no mechanism to smooth. And then that gets matched, compounded matched, and that's where the liability is, and that's why you see this graph. If you don't add to the liability to make up that guarantee during down markets, you get double savings. You don't add to the liability, you don't have to match it, and you protect the asset base.
Thank you.
Well, the only way we're adding to the liability would be if for some reason it's in negative, right? Wouldn't that still add to it? Because you're crediting zero, so you're not creating a negative crediting a negative number to their account.
Well, that's, Representative Cano, the liability could still increase that you've got two floors, really. You still have the full formula floor. Nobody's going to receive less than the full formula.
Right.
Now we're just talking about the interest crediting piece, the deficit reserve aspect.
Right.
And the second floor is that the members' Tier 1 money match calculation will never be less than with their account had it always been credited with the guaranteed rate, which started back in 1975, I believe. So it's not really saying you're not going to get the money match, but it's saying that your account will, when it's calculated will not be accumulated with interest any less than the guarantee over your career, not just year by year. Now, what's happening, though, is that you need to understand that the combination of eliminating the 6% contribution going into the account, plus the prospect of no interest for several years, accelerates the time for folks who are still going to be with us in Tier 1 for a number of years, accelerates the time in which they get back to the full formula, back to the 1.67 times years of service. House Bill 2003 just had the eliminating the 6% contribution, and the purpose of that was to get members back to the full formula. This, by adding this mechanism on the reserving for interest credits to that, diverting the 6% to a different plan, accelerates the time at which you come back to the full formula.
And I missed the number as it relates to the three proposals together. I see that, I'm sure it's in these papers and I just haven't seen it, but I saw the one number for the 4.9 billion or whatever for the 8%, but the other two issues together, what are those?
Well, you need to be careful because you can't add these together. That's why in our report on page 7, we put what you call a combining or CERS reform proposal combined, because if you lower the accounts, you don't quite get the savings you thought with the actual equivalency factors and so forth. You've got to be careful about combining these elements. But this package together that Margaret has described today, along with House Bill 2001, and House Bill 2004 would reduce the unfunded actuarial liability by about $9.1 billion. The employer contribution rate would decrease from an average of about 16.5 to just under 8. In addition to that, there would be some employers that would need to negotiate what to do with the pickup. So that may still be on top of this, but that's another issue.
So my rough math then is that 2001 was almost a billion off unfunded liability, not quite, and 2004 was about $1.5 billion roughly, so we can, let's just say, $2.5 billion for sake of rounding, which helps me a lot. So you say it's $9.1 billion in savings minus the $2.5 billion, which we've already done. So this proposal essentially is around a $6.6 billion House Bill 2003. Because we're going to, if we go to ask you for a fiscal, we'll ask you for a fiscal on this one. So that's that's a rough range.
Yes.
Okay. That's helpful. Other questions? Margaret, is it your intent or is it your request that we turn this proposal into legislative amendments? Because I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it is our request that we seek amendments to House Bill 2003 to incorporate these suggestions.
We'll be done. Also, as it relates to House Bill 2003, would you guys have an opinion from the governor's office on the call that currently exists in that bill? It moves the call from 5 years to 10 years. I honestly, my opinion is that's too long of a time period. I prefer it be 7 years because I know the calls will start to come sometime around. Well, Mark can probably tell us exactly when they're going to come, but it seemed to me it was like the beginning of 2005 that they would start, and I didn't want to have us in a situation where we have to come in or deal with that issue at the beginning of a session or come in for a special session in order to deal with that.
Well, Representative Knope, that's a good question. This particular proposal will eliminate the deficit reserve faster because the interest, let's say, for example, the fund earns 8% interest. In Tier 1, you're not going to credit any interest as long as there's a deficit reserve. So the mechanism of this governor's proposal in itself will help bring the deficit reserve back to zero. I've not looked into how long that would take with the proposal and without the proposal. We can certainly do that for you if you'd like.
Okay. I think
Yeah, I think it's an issue. Do you guys have an issue with the call? Or
Mr. Chair, we agree that it would be unfortunate to have the call take place in the next year or two, so we are in favor of extending that. But this mechanism itself also helps.
Absolutely. I would agree, but I just...
I think your proposal is... I believe it's fine. I'll have to check.
Okay. Other questions? We really appreciate you coming in and giving this to us, and as I said, we're happy to draft amendments. And these will be very technical in nature, so I'm sure Dave is excited to get right to it. And we do, as we all are aware, we have a deadline that we really need to meet, and this is a significant budgetary issue as it relates to what was presented today. And actually, some of these savings are already assumed in that budget. So if you fail on this, you have blown a hole wide open in the budget. So I think it's important that we get the amendments and begin to take testimony on those. Thank you. Senator Corcoran, are you still here? Did you want to testify on this proposal? Or
I'd like to comment on
that. You may.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tony Corcoran, Senate District 4. I'm glad you brought up the deadline to render. I think that that's a very important element. I think this has really helped us, in some respects, get to a resolution on this. I think that I believe that the savings in this will get us where all of us that have been working on this would intend to go. I want to really commend your work, commend the work of Margaret Halleck, and commend the work of your colleague Representative McPherson on this. And I think that this is one of those rare occasions in high profile politics where we've actually done the bipartisan thing and done the problem solving. Looking at this as a person who's worked in the labor community, I would say that these numbers are stunning. This is a huge hit to folks that are in the system, that have just gotten out of the system, and having said that, I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. So I guess I'm just here to say that I think that this gets us to resolution of almost all the issues in front of us, except for obviously the successor plan, and we can have that discussion. I think that's a much simpler discussion to have, frankly. I think this is the most difficult aspect of everything we've done so far, and I really want to commend everybody that's participated in it. So that's my 2 cents.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate you coming today, and I'm sorry to keep you waiting. I felt like it was important to get the whole proposal out there before we...
I would not have come up before they were done. My head hurts now, but I would have not have come up before they were done. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to come up today during the work session? And the reason we're having work sessions is because the speaker has requested we only have work sessions from here on out. So we already have had public testimony on, I think, all the bills that are up. So... that's the reason we're having work sessions, but I'm happy to open it to public input if there be any other today. Obviously, the amendments are not ready on this particular bill, but hopefully will be in the near future. Seeing no one else wishing to come forward, we're going to... I'll recess the public hearing on House... work session on House Bill 2003. And, colleagues, I believe we have amendments to House Bill 2020. I will open a work session on House Bill 2020. We have a dash 6 amendment. And a fiscal. Representative Richardson.
Yes.
And Dave, who is our legislative counsel, helped craft these and spent a fair amount of his time recently doing those. Why don't you come up? And Dennis, did you want to help present that?
Are we talking about 2020?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, we are. Mr.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we began this process of determining what could be a successor plan that will be in existence for the next 45 to 50 years, it was decided we wanted to have something that was reasonable, affordable, and predictable. We've been reminded today that the governor wanted something that was fair, affordable, and sustainable, and so basically we were looking for the same things. In the final draft that we have for House Bill 2020, which is a dash six, because we've gone through several amendment processes as we've tried to get it ready to present to the committee, we feel that we've been able to accomplish all of those goals. This plan must be reasonable in that it has to provide a reasonable expectation for benefits for the employees when they reach their retirement. It needs to be affordable for the employers and the taxpayers, and it also has to be predictable so that we don't have benefit creep and find ourselves in the same position that we're in presently with the PERS plan, which sounded so good when it was presented a couple of decades, well, actually 50 years ago, but even in the 80s and early 90s, it was still a financially sound plan. I was pleased to hear Ms. Halleck indicate that we need to have a more pay-as-you-go scheme when she was talking about the problems that we have with the current PERS problem, because we want to make sure that that same philosophy would apply to keep us from getting into that kind of a problem in the future. To assure that we have reasonable benefits, in the past we've gone over the figures that have shown what actual stock market results have been for retirement plans such as that administered by TIA CREP over the last 30 years, 20 years, and they've been between 8% and 10%. And we also know that with Actuary Johnson's estimate that we're going to have an 8% 40-year average return, that if we can use those figures and we show that with wise investment pools, that we can have a reasonable rate of return and a good retirement, especially when it's added to Social Security once we get the retiree gets to that age. As far as the affordability is concerned, by having this be a defined contribution plan, we know from the outset what the employer is going to have to pay. He doesn't have to worry about, in a down market, having to come up with unexpected expenses to make up the difference in a defined benefit plan to meet those benefit requirements, and make those benefit requirements up at a time when, because it's in a negative economy, business may be the worst, you know, for all the employers, for all who have an expectation of income and how they're going to have to spend what they have. The predictability in this instance, as we're going to review with you, is against benefit creep, is provided by having a provision which says that these benefits are in place, and if they're to be increased, it can only be done with the acceptance by the member employers. And so before the legislature 10 years from now comes in and says, by golly, we're in a great boom time, let's give greater benefits, the employers would have to be consulted, and they would have to, each of them would have to say, yes, we agree to that, rather than have it just be foisted on them by a well-meaning legislature that doesn't have to pay the bill when the market drops. And so we've reviewed in the past what the basic plan is to do, how it works, with a base of 3% and then a match of 1 to 2 for the employer and employee, which would end up with a match at 6% paid by the employer and 6% paid by the employee. And then for police and fire, that match would work its way up to 7.15% being paid by the employer. And so those are that's the overview of the plan, and if you'd like, we can go section by section, or we can just take questions that are more specific in nature.
Well, we probably might want to go section by section unless everybody, Representative Butler.
Just one question. Is this a 457 plan? What's the...
This is a 401A plan.
Okay.
The Oregon Savings Growth Plan is a 457. And the truth is that they could actually be coordinated in a way that would be beneficial for the employee if you had an employee who wanted to maximize his contributions, in that they would both be administered by OIC, the Oregon Investment Council, and so there could be contributions made by the employer into the FAIR plan, and the employee could make tax-exempt contributions into the 457 plan, and then if he had extra amounts, he could also make them into this 401A plan. So there's a lot of flexibility with this plan that would allow an employee to put in a substantial amount of money of his own, looking toward an even greater retirement benefit.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So what we're saying is that through a combination of and we've seen information this past week which indicates that Oregon's employees are making fairly sizable contributions to retirement plans. What we're saying then is that if that trend were to continue, then that could actually benefit the employers by reduced Social Security tax to the employee's contribution that they would decide to go ahead and put into the system.
That's correct. It has the opportunity to benefit both sides of this equation, which is the fairness that we're seeking for.
Excellent. Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a 401A, which I'm not totally familiar with, what's the earliest age people could retire under that? When can they start drawing their retirement without penalty?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I believe that currently it would be 57 and a half, or it could be at a younger age if it's actuarially, if the benefits are actuarially computed. But for a more specific answer, maybe you'd know.
And what I'm asking is public safety employees. Is it now, I mean, would they have to wait until 57 and a half before they can retire their
earnings? No. Representative Barker, the PERS plan is a 401A plan. That's what PERS, the current PERS system, is under. And as you probably know, normal retirement age is 58 for non-police and fire and 55. For police and fire with as early as 50 for a police officer with 25 years of service. So those are certainly within the boundaries of what's allowed by a 401A.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative McPherson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I called you Representative Richard. I don't want to get the two of you mixed up.
It occurred to me, Mr. Chair, that since there's kind of a hole in the practice in my firm, which I've come with the experience that Representative Richardson is developing, he might well want to retool his practice and become a pension lawyer.
I was asked earlier how I felt about PERS. I thought, and what I said was, I've learned a lot. I've learned more about 401A plans than I ever wanted to know, but certainly not enough yet.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do have a couple questions here, and actually one of them is about that very issue, that is the difference between 401A and Section 457. It appears to me that this is intended to be a 401A tax-qualified plan, and since Section 401K, which is the mechanism by which that kind of plan allows employees to defer income on a pre-tax basis, is not available to governmental employers. The effect is that the contributions that are made under this plan would always be after tax. My question is that the intended result?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that certainly is a leading question in that it assumes that would be the case. And our understanding is that it's not necessarily the case that presently employers under an OAR that I almost had memorized. I thought it was like 432-09-000-200, but I may be off a little bit on that, indicates and allows the employer to deduct what is being contributed to the 401A plan so long as it is deemed as being paid by the employer. And so if it's just coming from the employee, then there is a problem with the pre-taxability. If it's being paid by the employer, which now we're talking about accounting aspects of it, that it could be deducted, as is the case with a pickup. Now, to follow up with that, before we get too burdened in that area, it's important that we realize that both the hybrid plan that's being proposed with 2008 and the defined contribution plan that we have here with 2020, they're both 401A plans, and they both will have to be dealt with under the same provisions. My understanding from the hybrid plan is that it's at a cost of 8.08 that is tax deductible to the employer, and then the pickup would be tax deductible as well if there is a pickup, but any other funds that are paid in by the employee are going to be probably after tax. In this instance, we're looking at a 401A plan that has either 6% being paid by the employer or 7.15% paid by the employer for police and fire. That is tax deductible. And then what takes place after that is subject to the same rules. And so it depends on just how it's going to be set up and calculated.
Does that mean that the one-third of public employers who aren't picking up, that those contributions are after tax as well then?
That is my understanding.
Okay. Did you want to follow up?
I do want to follow up, Mr. Chair. There's a key difference between this design and the hybrid design in that under the hybrid, the member contributions are not individually elected. They are provided by the employer, either by fixed by the employer itself or through collective bargaining through an agreement with the labor group. And in that situation, they can be received by a 401A tax qualified plan and can be pre-tax if agreed to on a pickup basis. I believe there's no way that a contribution that is individually elected by the employee can be picked up so that it becomes pre-tax. So that I see there's a transition rule in this the draft amendments that would allow for the continuation of the collective bargaining agreement commitments. It's section 10 of the amendments that the public employer shall continue to make those contributions under the Fair Retirement Plan until such time as the term of the agreement expires. Upon the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement, the participating public employer may not thereafter pick up, assume, or pay the employee contributions. So it looks to me as though for those employees who are covered by collective bargaining and who have a picked-up contribution, it would remain a pre-tax contribution under this set of amendments until the expiration of the current bargaining agreement. But the outside of that situation, all the member contributions would be after-tax contributions. And I guess I know you cited an OAR, and I would defer to Dave Hendricks' response as well if he had something to share on that.
Chair Knope, Representative McPherson, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel. My understanding of 401A is that if they are in fact truly employee paid, that they are post-tax. That the only way to avoid post-tax contribution is to have an employer paid payment of the employee contribution. The 2008-1 amendments that has your plan in it specifically refers to the ability to pick up or pay. That was the law that was passed in the 70s by Congress that first allowed in 401A plans to get a pre-tax treatment. And essentially they did it by saying, look, if it's the employee who's paying it, be treated like the employee's money. And hence, if it's the employee's money, the employee has to pay taxes on it before the contribution goes in. If the employer makes it on behalf of the employee, we will be willing to give it. We will treat it as though it's an additional benefit being provided by the employer, not tax being made before it went into the salary, in essence. One of the changes that were made in the final draft of the bill was to leave some wiggle room on the issue of employer-paid contributions, and it's in section 7 sub 2, which talks about the employee contribution. The earlier drafts have flatly prohibited employer contributions. This leaves open the possibility, as the language is now drafted, that you in fact have a structuring of compensation in such a way as to allow pre-tax treatment of those contributions. And what that would have to be would have to be an employer-paid contribution for the employer. I'm not aware of a way to acquire pre-tax treatment for employee contributions other than that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And I agree with you. I think the only way that could be accomplished is by taking out the element of individual employee choice. If it, as long as we have employee choice and it's a 401A qualified plan, it would be not be possible for it to be a pre-tax contribution.
So. No, Representative McPherson, I'm not sure how much the element of employee choice comes into it as far as, for instance, the amount or whether to make a contribution. The tax provision that allows the pre-tax treatment has to do with whether or not the employer elects to pay the employee contribution on behalf of the employee. I don't know of anything that conditions the ability of the employer to do that on having a mandatory employee contribution.
All right. Further, Mr. Chair? This is, I think, a discussion that we'll need to unfold over time, but would be my view at this point that these would be after-tax contributions, except for that narrow transitional rule that relates to the pickup. So then that's something that maybe if others have a perspective that would lead to a different conclusion, I'm open to persuasion on it, but that's my sort of strongly held view at this stage. Which leads to my next question, which is in doing projections of income replacement numbers for the plan, Representative Richardson, would you be planning to factor in the after-tax character of the employee contributions in those projections, since in effect, or the one way of thinking about an after-tax contribution as opposed to a pre-tax one is that it costs the employee an extra 30% to 50% of the amount that he wants to have land in the plan, because he has to pay tax on those dollars and, of course, on the tax dollars themselves. So it's a it's a more expensive way to save. And have you anticipated factoring that into the replacement ratios that are being designed on the plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I haven't considered factoring it in because it's based on a presumption that I'm not willing to go to. For instance, both the hybrid plan and this plan are based on 401A, and so for me to do that, it would mean that I would have to be saying, okay, the only way I'm going to be able to avoid the pre-tax problem is to have the employer pay more. And under 2008, the proposed House Bill 2008, with the pickup, the employer is paying 8.08 presently plus 6%. So the employer is going into this thing at 14.08%, and that's tax exempt. And that, and congratulations, that's wonderful. Except that the employers have to pay it for that to happen. In this plan that we're looking at with House Bill 2020, the employers have the opportunity not to be starting off a new plan in double digits, but be only paying either 6 or 7.15 and have the option of paying more. And I would refer you to Internal Revenue Code 414H2, where it talks about this, the for income tax purposes, whether it's deemed employer paid or employee paid. And the OAR that I wanted to refer you to is 459-009-0200. And in a combination, what we're trying to do is to qualify under the IRC so that the employer, it will be deemed to have made payments, but have it be actually under the OAR be handled as an accounting factor so that the employer is not having to be totally responsible for those, and that can be done by adjusting income in other ways. The actual way that works, you know, I'm not sure. What I am sure is this. We wanted to assure that employers not be found in the same position in 20 years that they find themselves in currently, with a defined benefit plan that begins at 14% plus and has the opportunity, and of course, maybe it doesn't have the opportunity, but if there is this opportunity for expansion, then in a down market, we could find ourselves in a difficult position, not what we're in presently right now, unless the legislature can really get around the way the year plan, the one that you proposed, is designed. But if the legislature was able to do that, as they've done in the past, then the employers could find themselves in a horrendous situation as we do presently. Not, maybe not as bad, but bad. what we're trying to do by proposing a plan where the employer is going to be paying a reasonable amount, 6 or 7.15, when in the private sector, the employer is generally paying between 3 and 5%. We feel that that is fair and reasonable, and it may not, if we want to move assumptions around, we will determine what the results are. All that we can promise is the employers will make these payments. The employees can contribute what they want, whether it's before or after tax, and over time, based on history, they will have a substantial retirement. If they do not plan, they will have a lesser retirement. If the stock market acts completely contrary to its history, it could be a very serious problem. Or if there's another bubble, they could do tremendously well. Life doesn't have a lot of guarantees, but what it does have is an opportunity in this instance for there to be a fair and reasonable, affordable, predictable retirement plan for future public employees at a cost that the employers and taxpayers can afford.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Let's focus back on the cost issue. It referred to the hybrid as being a 14% of pay plan, and it is. There seems to be a disagreement about who's paying the 14%. In fact, the defined benefit component is an 8% of pay plan plus 6% from the members, a total of 14. Your plan is an up to 12% plan, that is 6% employer, 6% employee, except my point is that the 6% doesn't cost the employee 6%. It costs the employee, say, 8% of pay because they have to use after-tax dollars to do it. So they have to reduce their income by 8% in order to net the 6 that will go into the plan. I mean, it's probably even worse than that, but it's at least it's 8%. So I look at the two programs, and I see a 14% of pay plan and a 14% of pay plan, and really the difference is that in the hybrid, it's the employers paying 8% and the members 6% on a tax-efficient basis. And in the defined contribution plan, it's the employers paying 6% and the employees paying 8%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson, you have, again, very clearly in a lucid manner explained what your position is, and I understand that, and I will not take as long as time to explain again mine.
Okay.
When the employers pay the pickup, they're paying 14%. It can be called whatever you want to, but it's still coming out of the employer's pocket, and so that is going to be tax exempt. If the employer paid less, then there would be less paid by the employer. All we're saying is that we're not clear on the exact tax ramifications because we are hoping that through the use of the federal code and OERs and the experience of our tax experts that we can benefit the employee in both ways. And there is another way, by the way. Excuse me for not going back earlier to what I had said to Representative Butler, and that is if it's about pre-tax dollars, then there is nothing to stop the employer from paying his 6% into the Fair Retirement Plan and the employee, his match, going into the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, which is a 457 plan, which is tax sheltered for the employee, and therefore the employee's got 12% in his plan and there's been no tax on it. And they can be invested together because they're being invested by the same OIC. Does that help?
You follow, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I don't see that in the amendment, that it could go into the Oregon Savings Investment Plan.
That's because the Oregon Savings Investment Plan is already in existence. And so that merely is a choice on a form. It has nothing to do with the establishment of 2020.
So what you're, Representative Richardson, what you're saying is that instead of the employee putting all of their contribution into the 401A defined contribution, they could put some of theirs into the 457 plan and get that tax deferral.
That is pre-tax. That is what I'm saying, Mr. Chair.
Treatment.
What I'm really trying to point out is that there is flexibility with this plan, and tax law is not carved in concrete. You have vehicles here between the 457 plan and the 401A plan that give you some flexibility to assure, to do all that we can to assure that the employee gets the best tax advantages possible, and still provide the predictability that the employers need so that we don't, in the future, have benefit creep and have problems where the employer is solely responsible for problems with the marketplace.
Well, I have another question, Mr. Chair, but I'm going to depart from tax law because the room is starting to empty. And
I'm sure it has nothing to do with tax law.
And it really was, it was just about Supreme Court, direct review by the Supreme Court on Section 21, and I was curious about what aspects of the Fair Retirement Plan raise concerns about whether there would be a breach of any contract right, and so I wanted to find out what the thing was.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we know of none. It's just that this is such an important part of a package that if there was going to be a challenge, we wouldn't want it to be held up any more than any other part of the PERS package.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I have nothing further, and again, I want to compliment my colleague on an excellent presentation. Having sat on that side of the dais and answered questions from this side, I know that it's not an easy thing to do, and he does a very good job of it.
That is the truth. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Representative Brown, at this time, I'll take a motion on those dash sixes. I believe we're in work session.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'll move House Bill or the dash six amendments to House Bill 2020.
Representative Brown has moved the dash six amendments to House Bill 2020. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair, is it your intention to open a work session on House Bill 2008 today?
Wasn't planning to unless votes were there on that. I assume that you were going to take your 2008 amendments and have them attached as a minority report to 2020.
That was the intention, and I just wanted it really as a prefatory to yes. that effort.
Yeah. Is there any objection to the amendments on House Bill 2020? Seeing no objection on the amendment, the amendment is adopted. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2020 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Brown has moved House Bill 2020 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Barker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things about a 401k is, in my opinion, it's not a retirement plan. It's a savings plan. It's a good third leg stool kind of thing. And in the discussion we just had, we talked about should the market be negative, everything could go down, it could be a disaster. And what it would be a disaster for would be the employee who's worked 40 years in public employee in public employment and suddenly finds himself without a pension that they can retire on just due to the derogation in the market at that time. And that's why I'm going to vote against this plan, because I believe we need to have a piece of stability, which is in the hybrid plan. So,
Representative Barker, if I may comment on your comment. To some degree, I think your statement is accurate, but what I would say is, in fact, we are in disaster, but we're in disaster in a defined benefit plan that we're currently trying to replace. And so the difference that I see is, in the end, who's really responsible? In this particular case, the taxpayers of Oregon currently are responsible for this disaster, and we're responsible to try to figure out how to mitigate and work ourselves out of this particular predicament. And the 2020 plan that Representative Richardson has brought forward, I think, simply says that this is fair, this is what we can afford, and it's certain in terms of what the employer puts in. And at that point, then there's no more responsibility by the employer, i.e. the taxpayer, to make up the losses when those losses happen. And we currently have a plan that's, a PERS retirement plan, which has been great for many public employees, but it's only 66% funded. And even as bad as things have been for corporate retirement plans, I think I read that the other day in the newspaper that GM's pension plan is only 75% funded, so we're even lower than their corporate plan that's funded. So I guess my concern would be that we want to make sure that we don't get into the situation again in the future. And I don't have a particular bent one way or the other in terms of whether it should be defined benefit, defined contribution, or a hybrid. But what I do want to see is fair, affordable, and certain. And my concern at this point is that the other plans that I've seen I think would border on affordable into the future, because I think they do start a little bit high. And also that they're not really certain, because there's the potential without some sort of mechanism to keep costs from escalating, that another legislature, none of us probably, but 20 years from now or 30 years from now, could end up back at the same place we are, but probably not to the degree that we are now. I think this current defined benefit plan that we have is, in some ways, is sort of a hybrid. You get to pick at the end of your service what the formula is and all that. But I don't think we could get into as deep a trouble, for instance, with the hybrid plan that's been talked about, that we are now. But there's still that possibility that we could get into financial trouble again, and I don't think Oregon taxpayers would want to come back to this place again. And the other comment I would make is I think we ought to all look at this as a work in progress. I don't think Representative Richardson or any of us would say, you know, this is it, there's no more discussion. But what I see is that this would move the discussion forward. I think it advances that, and it gives us an opportunity to really advance the arguments and move to the Senate. And, you know, they may craft something different. They may decide that they like elements of this plan, and they may incorporate it into something else. I don't know what they'll ultimately do. But clearly, I think this plan at this time has the votes and is a work that that we can put forward as a fair and affordable and sustainable plan for the future. Representative Barker.
And I appreciate that. And I also want to say I really appreciate the work that my colleague, Representative Richardson's done on this. I'm still concerned about a few employees getting caught in a downturn market and not being able to walk out the door. And I think the plan, the hybrid plan, would resolve that. The problem with today's plan is the one that Representative Butler identified when they gave out 20% when it was 8%, when the actuary said 11%. And I never heard about this, but that actuary should have been screaming at the top of his lungs on every table. And when this legislature is supposed to oversee that, and whose members are part of that plan at the police and fire level, didn't stop it. That was the error. And we would be riding out with a smoothing effect had they balanced that out, as I think also my good colleague Representative Richardson has pointed out that as well. And that's what went awry was the 1999 and so on payouts. So thank you.
Won't find any disagreement here. Representative Kefouri.
Thank you. Two comments to the points that you made. The first is that I disagree with your assertion that once the employer has paid out their 6% or whatever it might be, that they're through, because if they end up, as many retirees or potential retirees are in this market, with no retirement, then those employers and the rest of the state is on the hook, because we're going to end up paying for them through food stamps, through benefits, through the Oregon Health Plan. So they will end up paying one or the other. My other point is that I think to say that with this plan you have some stability because 20 years from now things won't change is dreaming, because as we know, this legislature can change anything at any time, and whether or not the plan is set up such that we can change it next session, we can always change it. That's the beauty of the legislature. They can always come back and make changes. So don't feel that you're safe by passing this through changes that might be made in 20 years. And lastly, I wanted to say that I think it's rather unfortunate that we've started off on such a good foot in this committee of having a bipartisan effort, that you have, with all due respect to the author of this plan, push forward a plan that you are not having any support from your Democratic colleagues in the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Representative McPherson?
Mr. Chair, of course, I have to offer up some comments at this point. And I would like to echo what my colleague just said about the bipartisan spirit, which I think has been the spirit the committee has generally worked in, and I've really appreciated that collegiate approach to these very difficult problems. And I want to applaud the work that Representative Richardson's done, because this is a significant sort of intellectual undertaking to work through a program like this, and I think he's done a good job of presenting a plan of this type. The reason I'm going to vote against it is because, just on a sort of fundamental philosophy, I believe it's wrong. We ask our public employees to look after our children, to look after our vulnerable neighbors, to look after ourselves and our lives and property. And I think we ought to look after them. And I think this plan doesn't do that. It's got a 3% contribution, which is all that a public employee in the state will get, that without having to make an individual choice themselves to put money away. And that 3% contribution then gets accumulated, but it has to be directed, invested by the member, and that member may or may not make good investment decisions, and markets may or may not be kind to that member. That member has an opportunity to borrow of that money out, and the experience with the loan feature of 401k plans is that a certain proportion of the participants borrow against their retirement because they have pressing needs that they feel at the time, and they don't repay that amount, and what it just accumulates to the point where it defaults or it's against their account, and then their account is reduced by the amount of the balance that was borrowed. And because you can borrow up to half of your account balance, but that's if it were borrowed against the employer contribution, which is pre-tax, then you owe tax on it, on the amount of that defaulted balance. So it's really more than a hit on just the balance itself. It's because you have to pay tax on what you just received then, because the original loan is pre-tax, but when it's defaulted, you owe the tax bill on those dollars you received already in cash. So it was essentially taking a loan from this kind of plan and then not repaying it would decimate a member's account. So it's just not the relationship that I think we ought to have with our public employees. We ask so much of them to do for us, and to abandon them to this kind of regime of kind of you look after yourself, you're okay, but if you don't, you don't, and it's tough if you don't. I just think it's not the kind of state I want to live in. So I'm going to vote no.
Representative Butler.
I didn't hear my good colleague say he was going to vote no and move out of the state. I didn't.
Didn't say that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think some of the views that are being expressed are really very myopic, very short-sighted, because any period of 10, 20, or 30 years in the marketplace, with the exception of perhaps those of us who are only looking right now at the Enrons and the other folks who have gone upside down and who did not have the ability to invest. And I wish there was a method whereby we could legislate good common sense in investment. But we can't. And so if folks wanted to go ahead and put full investment packages into single stocks with their particular share, it's a good possibility they could do that. But the concern I've got is that the long term, and I think from my years in involving counseling folks with their own finances years ago, I used to have charts that would show you could almost any period of 10 to 12 years you would still come out of the market, assuming that you didn't put all of your eggs in one basket. So I think that we've got to take a look at the long-term approach. And then I think the revelation that Oregon employees, Oregon public employees, have a greater than average propensity to invest in overall instruments in the marketplace gives us a pretty good indication that those folks are becoming more and more sophisticated. And I wish we could legislate common sense in that process, so that they wouldn't do what I've done in some cases and put money in Enron and then a few days later find out it was down a rat hole. So, and that's an unfortunate situation, and that's one of the risks that you take. But you also take some upside risk too, and that pays out. So I would hope that when we look at this overall package, we take a look at the entire picture of an employee's useful, employable life, And I believe that our employees will, in fact, come out quite excellent, if not better than many other plans in the private sector.
Thank you. The other comment I would make is that some have asked about the disability issue in this particular legislation and the fact that there isn't a disability portion in here. And I would just like to make clear that as Representative McPherson indicated with his plan, there was some concern about tying disability into the retirement. But I will commit that as it relates to disability that I think we do need to act on that, but I think act separately, and especially as it relates to police and fire. So I want to make that commitment on the record. Representative Richardson, did you want to say anything, or are you worn out by your earlier testimony?
Well, I think it's all been said.
Anyone else? With that, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative Tabori?
No.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Merlin?
Excused.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Chair Canoe?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2020 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crafori.
I serve notice of a possible minority report.
I'm crushed.
I am. Perhaps you don't play any part of it.
And I'm caught off guard. Representative Richardson, would you like to carry?
I would, thank you.
All right. Representative Richardson will carry the bill. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2020.
Yeah.
And I think we have a recessed hearing or work session. Did I recess that?
Sure.
Just in case, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2003. Dave, did you have enough information as it relates to the amendments that that Margaret Halleck from the governor's office wanted on House Bill 2003?
I believe that Representative McPherson has the details. Well, be in touch with him. We've already talked about it, but I do need a little more help, I think, after hearing the president.
The sooner the better, I think, so we can begin to see drafts on that, because I understand that there's a jam up in the copy editing arena down there, and we don't want to be delayed, especially on House Bill 2003, because it does have some huge budgetary consequences. With that, thank you, and we are adjourned.